So anyway, my period is supposed to start in 1950, and what I remember about 1950 is that I was in junior high school and dreading to go to some mixers at the YM and YW, where a young Philatola, not the one that Sam was referring to, but someone that was in school with us, had an orchestra of several pieces that played at all our dances. And when the boys finally kicking and screaming did go, they generally wound up in the men's room flipping quarters or shooting dice. But by around 10:45, they decided that maybe, just maybe, they might want some feminine companionship to go to Hyde's Diner and have some French fries. So out to the dance floor, they'd go to dance to Perfidia or Moonlight in Vermont and then hustle on out of there. So that's my first recollection of what music at a young age. Of course, it was a transition period, and I know that there was activity that was going on in the area, as Sam had referred to. There was a pretty healthy country and western contingency with Tex Rowe and Wayne Schramm and the Ozark Mountain Boys and the Rolettes with Paul Elbro and several groups that were playing on a regular basis. Again, a very vibrant community and very well supported. One of the most prominent acts that came out of Cortland at that time had been on the road with the MCA booking agency for a few years after the war, and they were known as the Cosmo Brothers, Pat, Sam, and Phil. Yes, thank you very much. Very deserving. What some people may not know about the Cosmos is that every one of them served in a different branch of the service in World War II. Thank you. And they had children and needed to go to school, they decided maybe they couldn't do this road thing anymore. They played major hotels and lounges all over the country, played for such, met such dignitaries as Jeff Chandler, who played Cochise in the movies. And Phil Cosmo related to me that there was a hotel in Connecticut they used to play that the Chief Justice, Earl Warren, used to come and dance because he could. So the Cosmos came back to Cortland, and my first affiliation with them was in the mid-50s when I was getting, late 50s, when I was getting started. I had learned that the people I was going to be involved with later on were going to have to join the American Federation of Musicians. And we had a very strong local here, local number 528. And when the Cosmos came home, a couple of them, Pat and Sam, became very active in the union. Pat was on the board, and Sam was the business agent. And this was a little bit of a turbulent period because now, these people had made money playing all this time, and along come these ragamuffin rock and roll people who are going to take their business away, and they weren't terribly thrilled about that, especially an upstart little guy from the South End that wanted a booking license that was going to promote these people. So there were some issues in the early 60s with that transformation. I was in college in Utica, at what is now Mohawk Valley Community College, I think. And I came home after my freshman year, and my brother Nick, who was about 15 at the time, was all excited about how great and wonderful Elvis Presley was, and was crazy about the music, and they began to have all kinds of records around, and he and Ronnie Pettibon had gotten together, and they'd gone to some dances where they heard a group from Ithaca that was making a little bit of name for themselves by the name of Bobby Comstock and the Counts. And they really thought, man, this is such a cool thing that somebody can run their fingers up and down a guitar like that and jump around the stage. Maybe this was for them. Well, in the next year's time, they found some people, John Kane and Tommy Rogers and Jerry Bonowitz and Billy DeWolf, that they thought they ought to form this unit, and they called themselves the Vegas Kings. And I came home, and I had a little illness, and I was getting ready to have some surgery, and my brother comes to me and says, "We need a manager. Why don't you be our manager?" I said, "What does a manager do?" And he says, "If we knew that, we probably wouldn't ask you." So that was my introduction to the rock and roll world from that standpoint. And we began to try to figure out what to do. Now, we played some record hops for radio stations up in Syracuse, mainly WNDR, and we went to Emerson Park in Auburn because they had dances every Saturday night over there. And you didn't get paid for this. You got gas money. And you heard your name on the radio. That's really about all it took to get these guys excited for a while. But little by little, I mean, they're music every day, buying equipment and stuff and guitar strings, and maybe they had to figure out a way to pay for this stuff. So maybe we ought to figure out a way to make some money. So we began to promote some dances at the American Legion on Grant Street, American Legion in Homer, Sunday afternoons, and we could pack the place. I remember one incident in 1959 where I was working on Clinton Avenue for Sam Parginoni, who had a sports shop there, and a couple of girls called me and said, "We have nothing to do tonight. Can't you get something together and put a dance on?" I said, "Can you get a crowd here? Because we have no way to tell people." This was about 3:30 in the afternoon. 10 minutes to 8, there were 300 kids standing out in front of the American Legion on Grant Street to see Ronnie and Redcaps. So, 1959, 1960, we managed to get into the studio up in Syracuse. Because already the whole idea of this was to get to the next level. That you didn't want to play high schools and bar rooms. You wanted to be a recording star. After all, these guys were making it left and right across the country and getting hit records, and you wanted the same thing. So we did go up there, and the gentleman that owned the studio took a big interest in the group. And the particular song that we chose was off a Bobby Rydell album, an obscure song called "An Angel Is Missing." And we made that record, and it went to number one in Syracuse. And we did sell what they call the master, which is the tape that they make the records from. We sold that to a guy in the Bronx who had called me to buy it. Wanted to know if we'd sell it, and we said, "Well, we can't distribute it nationally. We might just well let him try and do it." And he had a record off that was starting to do something. He was the manager of a group called the Regents, who had written and recorded a song called "Barbara Ann," that later was a big hit for the Beach Boys. And so the record came out, didn't do a whole lot, but well, we got started. And that next summer, 1960, they decided, now, you know, maybe they can make a living doing this. So where do you play in the summertime? Well, we headed for Lake George to audition. And Donnie Barber, who had gotten started by then, was already in a club up there, right down the street from where Ronnie was going to be. And the two groups spent the summer there and came home. No one will ever realize what 56 days of 4 hours on and 4 hours off in a club can do to a band. It made them so tight and so strong that when they came back, they were a real band. And then I had to think about making a living, so we decided we had to have a booking agency, and that there were other bands forming. A young man by the name of Dale Southworth, who was the father of Steve Southworth, Rockabilly Rays, had started a group called the Majestics with Billy Pierce and Bobby Petrella and Dick Medoff. They were about the second group here. And out from Norwich comes Joe Leo, who had a group called the Crystals with Joey St. Georgie and Billy Stanchy. And from that came Mickey Lee and the Persians and Cal Dean and the Showmen and the Sindels. The Sindels were a very prominent group in the early 60s. I don't know those of you who remember, but you must remember there was a 12-year-old drummer who was a mighty fine musician by the name of David Feinstein, who today runs the Hollywood, and later became prominent with Elf and the Rods. These groups, we had had a presence at Cornell University because there was an agent over there who managed Bobby Comstock, who controlled the 55 fraternity houses there, and we would get plenty of work there. But, you know, that wasn't every week. So my ex-wife and I decided, well, maybe there's another outlet. So there's a building on Church Street that is now manned by my first cousin, Kay Zaharis, who we went over to the library and did our research and put together a mailing list of about 900 fraternity houses. Now, I knew that if I mailed to these fraternity houses, I wasn't going to be able to just automatically sell them these bands. I had to give them some inducement. So I told them they could call me Collect. And that really worked. I mean, these social chairmen were tight with their money, and if they didn't have to pay for a phone call, they thought that was kind of cool. What was uncool about it was when they called Collect to cancel. That we didn't care for. But by 1962, we had made some strides in some of the universities around the East. I remember going to Amherst with Ronnie the first time we went to Massachusetts. And the first job that we booked out of state, happened to be Mickey Lee and the Persians, which was Mike Sewell and Buddy DiStefano and Bobby Petrella and Bobby Nossif, for $175 went to Middlebury, Vermont. And it worked because we got enough phone calls out of that to book a pretty substantial weekend the next time that they had a party there. And that's really how it worked. If you saw the movie Animal House, the only contrast between us and what you saw in Animal House was that in Animal House, the band that they emulated had a black front singer, organ, sax, guitar, maybe a guitar, and bass and drums. Our groups were white, for one thing, and basically guitars, bass, and drums, sometimes the sax, and sometimes a keyboard. But there were schools that it was very difficult to get placement on because they liked the Animal House style band, not what we had to sell. Those predominant schools were Dartmouth and Colgate. Where we were very successful was places like Bucknell. There were times we absolutely dominated Bucknell. At that time, we were doing some recording because I had sort of joined forces with the man from Ithaca, and he was helping us make some strides in the recording business. And we pretty much were on a label with Ronnie, at least most of the time, at that time. And 1963 saw quite a bit of recording. There was one situation in 1963. I did mention Chaldee and the Showman. Carl Falso, who was the son of Tony Falso, who was a guitarist that played in Al Falso, who ran a music store here for a long time. Carl was an absolutely brilliant young musician. And he had a nice group with Bobby Pettigrossi and Art Belton. But Carl had an Achilles heel. He was so well trained musically that he couldn't write simple three-chord songs. And it was kind of frustrating because he had a brilliant mind. Well, Bobby Nossif was exactly the opposite. Bobby was not formally trained, but he had an incredibly commercial ear. And the tragedy was that Carl's mother, who was a British war bride, died of breast cancer, I believe, in 1963. And Bobby sat Carl down one day because Carl was a wreck. He was not good with this death of his mother at all. And Bobby wanted to bring him out of his funk. He says, "We're going to write a song." He said, "But we're going to write it not your way. We're going to write it simply, and it's going to appeal to the radio stations." So they come to me, and they've got this little bubblegum song called "Mind Your Mama." And basically, that's what it says, that you should listen to what your mother has to say and pay attention and do accordingly, because someday she may not be there. Well, at that time, we had some acts on Swan Records in Philadelphia, which was Freddie Cannon's label. He was the big star of the label. And Bobby Comstock and Ronnie were both on the label. So we took the record down there, and they said, "My Lord." He listened to it and he said, "This really is crap, bubblegum crap. But maybe somebody will play it." Well, we had Mohawk Airlines operating, at the time, and they had a plan where if you bought a ticket on Monday morning for $75, you could fly the entire week, any place they went. So I got on the plane one Monday morning, traveled 30-some-odd cities till Friday. I had 80-some-odd stations on the record. In fact, I was home Thursday night. Friday, I had a little record shop down where King Submarine is for about 6 months, and I went over to the tavern to have lunch. And Bobby Viviano was running it then, rest his soul. And I'm sitting there having lunch, and we're watching television, and there's Walter Cronkite at 10 minutes to 1 telling us that the president's been shot in Dallas. And commercial radio went off of all popular music for 3 days. And we lost the record. Couldn't get it back. And I absolutely believe that that was the closest I ever came to a hit record. But things happen for a reason. And but it taught me that you need to keep things simple and not get too cute musically when you're playing for young people. But as time went on, we did have a lot of record activity, and it really did help to advance the groups. One of the problems that we had through the 60s was that we just couldn't find a niche for Ronnie. He had such a versatile voice and could do so many different kinds of things, but we hadn't hit on a sound of his own. It wasn't until 1973 or 74 that he found his way. And as we would say, the rest is history with him. You know, so many people followed that direction around here. We had so many incredible ensembles. I said I wouldn't get into a thing like an award show where I'm naming a lot of people, but I do want to pay some credibility to some of the pairings. I happened to see a segment on the CBS Sunday morning show this morning, some of you may have seen it, with Stephen Van Sant, who plays Silvio on The Sopranos and was originally with the Bruce Springsteen band. And he told what a kindred spirit he and Springsteen had going for many years. And that's sort of what happened here in a lot of situations. I'm going to name some of those pairings, and I'm sure those of you who recall the groups will understand where I'm coming from, in particular Ronnie and my brother Nick, Don Barber and Skip Sirely, David Feinstein and Gary Hall, Buddy DeStefano and Tom Haskell. Mickey Lee Sewell and Bill Pierce, and Joe Leo and Brian Miles. Those are the ones, Steve Corey and Rick Plant. Those are the ones that I recall that if those combinations hadn't worked as well as they did together, the groups that they were successful with probably wouldn't have done as well. As the 60s progressed, we did get a lot more recording activity. We had a lot of places that we sent groups to play. One of them was down in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. And into the club in Hazleton one night wanders a guy by the name of Mike Joyce, who was affiliated with Neil Diamond, who I knew Neil. I'd had some coffee with him a couple of times. And Neil was always looking for outlets for his songs. He had not started recording yet himself. And Neil took and Mike Joyce took a liking to a group that originally came from Watertown that had several people from Cortland in it, including Tom Haskell and Ed Borella and Al Garrison, and of course, one of the most prominent percussion men in the world today, Mark Nossoff, who's, I believe, with the Hamburg Symphony in Germany, a great recording percussion person. But anyway, they took Will under their guise and took him in the studio and made an album with him, a great album that I think was great, has now been re-released in Europe again. And I have to do this because it shows you the irony of how popular music works. Claudia Wolf was the lead singer of the group most of the time, and Ed Wolf, her brother, did all probably what she didn't do, he did the rest of the vocals for the most part. But when they went into the studio and came out, the single that ABC Paramount decided to release, the lead singer on it was Tom Haskell from Portland. So you just never know where these things are going to come from. Another group that, and when I mention some of these things, they may not naturally be Cortland people, but they gravitated to Cortland because they wanted to be part of what was going on here. We had a thing happening here, and I don't want us to be compared to Syracuse or Ithaca, because per capita, we had it here. Just good. Just the way it was. And some of the people that found their way here, there was a group from Skinny Atlas who was very creative by the name of Free Will. And you'll see their name, a couple of their names still, Joe Whiting and Mark Doyle. They were originally with Free Will, and they were pretty good writers. And we did get them a huge contract, six-figure advance with RCA Victor. The record, the album never did anything, and the money probably didn't get used very well, but enough of that story. The other one that comes to mind was, or a couple more, we had a group up at the college by the name of the Coming Generation. They were all students at the college, and they later became the Magic Gong, and were another very creative force. In fact, the leader, Dave Porter, later went on to form a group called 805 that was very successful in Syracuse. And that group had a pairing that I thought were great catalysts, in Dave Porter and Danny Pickering. In fact, they went 3 years in a row to play at the Newport Jazz Festival, when the Newport Jazz Festival was all rock and roll after Woodstock. And I was there one day when Frank Zappa was there and told everybody to sit in their seats and behave themselves. And Led Zeppelin was there, and about 300,000 girls there. I didn't see any men. Which I left out a story about Ronnie. When we were first starting out, one of the things that we were pretty good at, or seemed to be good at, was backing up name acts. And down in the Triple Cities, there was a disc jockey on the radio station by the name of Joe Julian. And he used to run these huge record hops at the Endicott Johnson Recreation Centers in Johnson City, Endicott. And Ronnie went down there to back up Frankie Avalon and Fabian and Bobby Rydell. And I can tell you, maybe there were some males in the audience, but I didn't see any. That's when we had what we called true teenage idols. The last story of that ilk I want to share is that David Feinstein, after leaving the Rods, joined up with Carl Kennedy and a couple other people and developed a group called the Rods, and I felt they were one of probably the most prominent acts in Portland during the 70s. A lot of recordings, a lot of European acclaim, and what I find gratifying is that they're still at it. They're still out there trying to crack through, and I applaud them for that. The last act that I want to mention from this contingency is a group that I think is marvelous. Every time they suit up and are going to play somewhere, the people just seem to come out of the woodwork, and that's the Jay Cafferty Band. Go ahead. Nice band. Steve Corey and Billy Strong and the people that were that unit during the 70s, and they went on to become New York Central. And now, every time Donnie Barber suits up, there's a bunch of those guys with him. And of course, Don himself had plenty of prominence because he was probably the most successful act from here at getting activity from the Syracuse stations. He managed to do that very well, and his name was widespread. And, you know, I don't think, as I listen to Marianne and Sam and we talk about the history of Cortland, you know, people will say, why was Cortland? Why Cortland? Well, if you listen to all this today, the people that these kids came from were all music people. A lot of these kids had music in their family. Their parents played. And to have that wonderful history of Adelson and Corky Fabrizio and Bert Stanley, I know that I used to think this was tongue-in-cheek, but Ross Schaefer, who was the athletic director at the high school during the 50s and early 60s, said to me one day, "Are you trying to ruin my baseball team?" He says, "Nobody wants to play ball anymore. All they want to do is play guitars." Now, having said that, Pat Cosmo was doing all the guitar teaching at McNeil Music later on, and Pat used to say, "Can't we get these guys to come for more than two lessons?" I said, "Well, they learned where to put their fingers, and they're figuring they're on their way." But I'd like to thank everybody for coming. I'm going to say something I've meant to say for many, many years. I don't think there's a place in the country that's as supportive as the people of Cortland have been for their music community ever. I just never have seen anything like that.
Well, that's an act you just can't follow. So with that, I'd like to thank Sam and Marianne and Jim for sharing all of their vast knowledge on the music history here in Cortland. And I'd like to thank Seth Scott for all the hard work that she put into organizing this event. And, of course, thank all of you for coming. I really enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope we can do more of these in the future. And now we're going to invite all the musicians down for a little jam session. That's what I understand it. So, and you're willing to stick around, or we're hoping you'll stick around and listen to that as well. You're invited. Thank you all.